From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Westwood Park.
Coming up, inmates work to combat violence in Richmond from behind bars.
Whether I go home or not, at least I know that I'm making a difference. That is, you know, I'm useful. I'm not just thrown away. I can actually affect change somehow.
Then we'll hear from our community storytelling project, Hear, Hear.
I think what happened to me was I'd actually gotten some trouble, and I was going through denial, and I actually met a guy in court, the bailiff.
And the lengths BART officials go to keep the trains moving.
We have to go truly looking at eBay in some cases to find certain parts that otherwise just aren't manufactured or on the market anymore.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. With one of the highest crime rates in the country, Richmond, California is a regular on the evening news.
Gunshots late tonight in North Richmond. Four people hit. We're told three of them are dead.
Richmond police are battling neighborhood gang activity, from street fights to graffiti on city property.
Richmond's murder rate is more than three times that of neighboring San Francisco, and it's one of the 100 most dangerous cities in the country. 9 miles west of Richmond sits San Quentin State Prison. Many of the men housed at San Quentin are originally from Richmond, and when they're done serving time, they plan to return to their hometown. But that might not be for another 20 or even 40 years in some cases. And that's a lot of time to think about mistakes, and it leaves many inmates stuck in a place of depression, helplessness, and guilt. One group of Richmond inmates, though, has been transforming those feelings into something constructive.
And so instead of us sitting in here and saying, man, we hopeless, it's over, there's nothing else we can do, we might as well start killing each other in prison too. We're starting to live. It's sad that we decided to live in a tombstone. But in reality, it's still hope as long as you breathe it. And so what we're trying to do is promote these brothers to take this energy that they have in here and embrace the ones that's out there and start this fire of love and leadership.
That's a meeting of the Richmond Project. Participating inmates say it's not just a typical prison program. It's a community initiative that just happens to be inside of a prison. KALW's Nicole Jones reports.
Past the barbed wire chain link fence and thick jail gates, go through the enclosed quad, and there it is, the San Quentin Prison Chapel. It's a place where a lot of the inmates meet for different groups, classes, and treatment programs. For most, their work ends at the prison walls. Not this group, though.
We want to help bridge that gap between the perpetrators, as you will, and the community.
Nate Collins is an inmate and president of the Richmond Project. It's a San Quentin-based group that works to improve conditions in Richmond from behind prison walls. Collins has been in prison since 2002, serving 60 years to life for second-degree murder.
You know, I've taken so much from Richmond. I've taken a life. And so, you know, this is my way of at least trying to give back. I won't be able to, you know, give back that life, but maybe I can stop, you know, someone else from taking a life.
Some of the men sitting in this room come from warring Richmond gangs. In the past, they couldn't be on the same street, never mind the same room. But these days, they're more likely to be talking about grant writing and fundraising for elementary school uniforms.
We want your freedom, right? But, you know, I just try not to focus on that. I just try to involve myself in whatever I can involve myself in to know that no matter my outcome, whether I go home or not, at least I know that I'm useful. I'm not just thrown away. I can actually affect change somehow.
One thing they're doing to affect change is running an essay contest for students at Richmond's Leadership Public High School. For the past 2 years, inmates have chosen topics for students to write about. It's a way for them to connect with the students and help find solutions to violence. They even organized cash prizes for the winners using the proceeds from snack sales in San Quentin.
I chose the one that, what would you do to help out someone?
Louis Ledesma, a 10th grader, won first place last year. He wanted to write about solutions to the violence in Richmond.
The shootings in this city have happened on a daily basis, and it makes most mothers terrified that their sons or daughters might get killed. In conclusion, I want to help the youth in Richmond because I'm part of it. I know how difficult it is to be raised in Richmond, and we need a place like this to keep us away from violence.
Leadership Public High School's principal, Jesse Madway, says participating in the contest was an easy yes, even after he realized that convicted criminals would read and judge the students' essays.
You know, we don't spend a whole lot of time, I think, speaking about what happens to the people in this community who make the decisions that end people up in a place like San Quentin. You know, we certainly have a lot of families who have, you know, where, you know, brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles have run into trouble in their life and have, you know, made decisions that have gotten them into places like this, like San Quentin.
That said, the students aren't allowed to have any direct contact with the prisoners. In his office, Madway tells Luis Ledesma that working with them is still a powerful experience.
I'm sure that it just feels incredible to them that they're connected to you writing this. And probably for, you know, some guys who haven't been attached to a whole lot of positive things in their life, to feel like they generated the idea for you to write about must have made them feel pretty good the night that they went to bed after reading your essay.
Back at San Quentin, Nate Collins is staying busy with college-level classes and other groups. He says he especially appreciates the Richmond Project's curriculum. Nearly everyone who's participated has managed to stay out of prison after their release. Collins thinks that could be because they talk about things like PTSD, community justice, relationships, and peer pressure. Things he wants young men like Ledesma to start thinking about now.
These are the same things that we recognize that we were going through then. We just didn't know the words for it. We didn't know what it was. It took, you know, unfortunately for us to come to prison and then to be fortunate enough to come to San Quentin and be a part of a lot of the groups here to start to put names and words to some of the feelings and things that we were going through.
The men know they're somewhat unlikely mentors. Like Collins, most of them will be incarcerated for decades to come, so they can't do this work alone. Since the group started in 2006, Richmond City Council members and the chief of police have joined their meetings to help them accomplish their goals. The men are currently working with a pro bono lawyer to become a fully operating nonprofit. And in the meantime, they're already planning next year's essay contest. In San Quentin, I'm Nicole Jones for Cross Currents.
You can learn more about the Richmond Project at our website. It's klw.org. That's also where you can hear all of our criminal justice coverage and subscribe to our podcast. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. The Richmond Project helps inmates use the lessons they learn in prison to change their community on the outside. But the main character of our next story learned his life-changing lesson one day in court. Ted Atkinson grew up in East Oakland, and while he watched his neighborhood decline throughout his lifetime, he'd also had his own run-ins with the law. He told the Hear Here community storytelling producers about a moment that set him on the right path.
Here? Here?
Here.
Okay, together.
Okay. Hear, Hear, from KALW.
My name is Ted Atkinson. I live on 81st Avenue. I think what happened to me was I'd actually gotten some trouble, and I was going through denial, and I actually met a guy in court, the bailiff. His name was Colonel Jim. He was an ex-Marine. He was a service guy, real calm guy, smooth talker. I'd never heard him, you know, he never raised his voice. I'd been to court two or three times, and I never heard him raise his voice. And he just, you know, he would, I guess, approach the young guys that he knew that was from the streets, that he saw hope in, I would say. And he saw me kind of moving around in my chair, and I was uneased about the situation. And he came and he put his forehead against mine. And he said, "Release that anger." And I didn't understand it at that point. But after I sat down and did what he asked me to do, I talked to him after the court proceedings, and I understood. I guess I did soul searching and said, "Look, this guy's not your enemy. He's trying to help you." And actually, the information that he gave me was to my benefit. And he invited me to Allen Temple. There was the men's prayer breakfast. And I got involved there, and that was the turning point in my life. And I started hanging around A-class people rather than the norm for me. And I started seeing the difference, the change in myself, and I liked it.
Ted Atkinson shared his story with Hear Hear, our community storytelling project. That piece was produced by Audrey Dilling with help from our partners at the 81st Avenue East Oakland Library. And if you want to share your story with us, just go to hearhear.kalw.org. And that's also where you can listen to other stories from your neighborhood and record your own right from your computer with our brand new app. You can check it out at hearhear.kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Last week, Californians voted on whether or not to end the death penalty and replace it with life without the possibility of parole. It was Proposition 34, and people in the state rejected it, electing to keep the death penalty. Inmate Richard Gilliam was watching the election closely. He's our correspondent behind bars, and he writes to us from the California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo. In this letter, read by Chris Hoff, Gilliam says as a prisoner, he has some unique reasons for advocating to change capital punishment, and they're probably not what you think.
Even though I am currently incarcerated in the California prison system, I, and most men in similar circumstance, do not feel any kinship toward those condemned to die. As a group, they are the most despicable specimens of inhumanity to breathe the same air. If they are guilty of the crimes for which they've been convicted, they deserve to be banished from society and punished every day of their miserable lives. But there is something we must bear in mind. Hundreds of former death row prisoners have been discovered to be innocent of the crime they were convicted of. So the chances that someone, or several someones, sitting on California's death row right now are innocent is just one compelling reason to amend the law. Another reason to change the law is the cost of maintaining it. A recent accounting placed the burden to taxpayers at $184 million per year. Since the death penalty was reinstated in California in 1978, only 13 prisoners have been executed, while, during the same period, 55 have died of natural causes, and 19 have committed suicide. This was as of November 2011. Averaging today's costs over the 34 years the death penalty has been in effect, it has cost taxpayers about $3.4 billion and counting. Death row advocates talk about closure for the families of victims, but how much closure or finality do they get when death row inmates file appeal after appeal, each one carrying with it the possibility that a reviewing court might reverse the verdict and start the emotionally painful process over again? And the reality is that most of these prisoners are dying of old age anyway. To those that believe a life sentence is not punishment enough, let me enlighten you. As it stands, men on California's death row are treated better than the average prisoner. They are assigned lawyers who ensure they receive all the privileges and amenities the law and the courts say they are entitled to. They enjoy a celebrity and notoriety not bestowed upon other prisoners due to their crimes and continued media attention. They are held up to the spotlight as victims, while the good people they victimize suffer the media hype and obscurity, and they are kept apart from other prisoners. If they were transferred from their secure accommodations and forced to live out their lives on a level 4 yard, most of them would become the target of other prisoners due to the nature of their crimes. Even prisoners as a group have a code of ethics. We single out pedophiles, rapists, and child murderers for personal retribution because most of us have wives, mothers, sisters, daughters, and sons. Therefore, most of these individuals would be banished to security housing units to live out their lives in solitude and obscurity. The only time anyone hears about Charles Manson or Sirhan Sirhan is when they come up for parole. And let's face it, nobody's ever going to let them out. If there was no parole, you would never hear about these guys again. And for those few that could walk a main line, I've been in a level 4 prison. Faced with interminable years confined to such a dangerous dystopia without reprieve, I would seek the release of death, thus giving my victim some satisfaction and saving the taxpayers the expense of even this existential support. And finally, we've all heard the phrase, a fate worse than death. But before coming to prison, I, for one, couldn't conjure up exactly what that could entail. Well, by defeating Proposition 34, the voters have spared those on California's death row that very thing. Take it from one who's been there. The next time this opportunity presents itself, and it is your wish to mete out the harshest punishment available, banish these men to a life without the possibility of parole, a life of pain, violence, solitude, and obscurity, and use the money saved for more deserving endeavors.
That commentary comes to us from Richard Gilliam, who's an inmate at the California Men's Colony State Prison in San Luis Obispo. Chris Hoff read his dispatch for us. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. The recent election gave Bay Area residents a chance to examine a number of local issues and problems, including things they wanted to change. An example of that is the BART board election. Two longtime board members were voted out in favor of new, younger candidates promising to change the way things are done. The train system has been making a few changes recently. They started building the controversial Oakland Airport connector, and this past summer they tried out a pilot program which allowed bikes on more trains. But there's one thing that is still the same. BART is only open until midnight. In discussions about extending BART's hours, one word comes up over and over again: maintenance. BART officials say that they have to close the system for a few hours each night in order to keep it working, especially as the cars age. In this piece from our archives, we sent KALW's Casey Miner to find out what they actually do down there in the wee hours of the night.
You might think BART stations would be quiet at 2 a.m. The platforms are empty, no trains rushing through. But they're not quiet. In fact, the noise is deafening. Huge machines run back and forth on long stretches of track, grinding down rails and carrying new ones. Crews deep in the tunnels take huge saws to pieces of metal. And cranes drop other pieces on the ground.
All right, get your flashlights.
Until recently, Don Emmons was BART's assistant superintendent for ways and facilities. But before that, he kept track of everything going on in the system, during the day and after hours. He drove me around to a few stations on a recent early morning to show me what goes on after the gates close.
Yeah, so the trains are leaving MacArthur right now, and they're all headed out to their final destinations to rest, and all the maintenance crews are waiting by the maintenance ways right now.
After 37 years with the agency, Emmons doesn't talk about the train system the way you or I would. Instead, he speaks fluent BART.
So this is an M-Line blanket coming down right now?
Here's the translation. The M-Line is the section of BART that runs from West Oakland all the way through San Francisco, down to Millbrae. A blanket is a section where they've powered down the rails after the last trains pass through.
Then they'll do M-17, and they'll do A-25, which is San Leandro. Sorry. When I say it to you guys, my wife cracks up because I go like, yeah, C-53. She's like, I don't know where that's at. So I got to think of in terms of where it's at.
Once you get through the jargon, Emmons's point is pretty simple. Maintenance crews need a safe area to do work, and they can't have it until after the trains are gone.
But what happens is the time frames that they have to do their work in gets shorter and shorter the further out you go.
This is the crux of BART's maintenance issue. There are more than 200 miles of track to keep up, and only a handful of yards where heavy machinery can be stored. Upkeep includes everything from physically inspecting train cars to replacing long sections of track. For a big job like that, it can take more than an hour just for the crews to get set up. Depending on where they need to go, they might not even start working until 1:45 a.m. Meanwhile, the first morning trains start running at 4, so workers have to be completely cleared out before that.
Yeah, it's sort of like ready, set, go.
Paul Overseer is BART's assistant general manager of operations.
And so we literally have people and vehicles and trucks and pickup trucks at the standby, at those locations, waiting for the last train of the night to pass by. We drop the power,
We put all the other safety measures in place that are required, and then away they go.
The tunnels are closed for 13 hours each week. Overseer says it's not enough.
That being said, stuff goes wrong every day.
Multiple times every day. The system is 40 years old. A lot of parts have been replaced over time, but a lot haven't. And when they do need replacement, they're not always easy to find.
And we have to go truly looking at eBay in some cases to find certain parts that otherwise just aren't manufactured or on the market anymore.
For example, some electrical components are hard to find, as are some parts of Bart's Fair Collection equipment. Overseer says shopping on eBay isn't common. If they need a lot of a certain part, they'll build it themselves or order it from one of just a few suppliers around the country. But that's expensive, and right now the agency is in a complicated financial situation. It has a surplus in its day-to-day budget, but nowhere near the money it needs for big projects like car replacement. Overseer says that's the gap Bart needs to fill.
So that when these things reach the end of their useful life, it doesn't take a heroic effort. It doesn't take, you know, doing crazy things in the aftermarket to try to find parts.
Bart workers don't just do maintenance at night. They're constantly monitoring different parts of the system.
Between Civic Center and 24th Street, we call it the rainforest because so much water sometimes when they're wintertime, you'll get a lot of moisture in there, a lot of rain.
When we arrive at the 24th Street station around 2:30 a.m., a crew is already well into the process of replacing a broken rail. Emmons says normally they'd save a rail replacement for the weekend when they've got a few extra hours to work. But they found this broken one during an inspection, and they have to fix it before more trains can run. If they're lucky, this crew will finish their work before the first morning trains are due to come through. If not, those trains and those passengers will have to wait. In the BART tunnels, I'm Casey Miner for Cross Currents.
You can find a link to that story and all of our transportation reporting at our website. It's kalw.org. And while you're there, you can sign up to get our podcasts. Again, that's kalw.org. Just click on News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. To get from the East Bay to San Francisco, you can take BART, or the ferry, or you can take the bridge. The new Eastern span opens in 10 months, and that will make for a seismically safe and beautiful ride for motorists. For bicyclists, not so much. For 2 years, cyclists will have to turn around before they reach Yerba Buena Island because the old Eastern span will be in the way. And once it's gone, they'll have to turn around at the island anyway because there are no plans to connect the path to San Francisco. But we're about to hear a simple way to make it happen in a segment we call Radical Ideas.
And now for something completely different.
First of all, think outside the box.
I got the idea when I noticed the refrigerator was cold.
Good idea.
The guy who invented Pringles packaging thought outside the box and made a fortune.
That's a pretty good idea.
He had this crazy idea about breeding pine trees.
Isn't that beautiful? That can happen to anyone.
Chris Carlson is co-founder of the monthly Critical Mass bike ride, and he oversees the historical website Found SF. The activist shared his radical idea for completing the Bay Bridge bike path with KALW's Ben Trefney.
Well, I think there's a great frustration on the part of this enormous population of bicyclists. Obviously, bicycling has increased 20-fold in the last 20 years since critical mass began on both sides of the bay. Just enormous numbers of people cycling every day. And many people would really like to be able to ride their bikes across the bridge after and not be BART pumpkins anymore, where you have to get on the BART by midnight or you're done and you're stuck on the wrong side of the bay. So the idea of being able to cycle across the bridge just seems like common sense to us. And now what we've done is we've actually started to really raise this idea that, you know, the Caltrans, formerly and probably better known as the Department of Highways, because that is their overarching priority and interest, is to make space for cars and car throughput. And that's their mandate, essentially, still to this day. But anyway, they're building this new bridge, right? The East Span.
The Eastern Span.
And they put on it a new bike lane and multi-use lane, thanks to the intense activism of bicyclists related to critical mass in the 1990s.
But it only goes to Treasure Island from the East
Bay. It's the bridge to nowhere for bicyclists. It goes to the middle of the bay and it stops. And there's no plan that's coherent yet to solve the problem of getting us across the entire bay. You're supposed to go down to Treasure Island and wait for a bus that runs every 20 minutes and takes two bikes. Obviously, nobody's going to make that commute under those conditions. I also have to point out, put that roadbed of the bike lane not on the north side of the bridge where it would have beautiful views and fresh air blowing on it. No, they put it on the south side of the bridge. So you're going to look at the hazy Port of Oakland and the old bridge while they tear it down. And they lowered the road deck just enough so your nose in a bicycle is exactly at tailpipe level. So you're going to have the prevailing winds blowing the car exhaust directly in your face the whole time on the East Span. And that, I really have to think they did that on purpose. They hate bicycles at Caltrans. They don't want to do anything for them. So all that taken as sort of the context of the moment, their claim is that it's going to take – they're spending $2 million on a study again. They already have the study from 2001. And the study is to show how you could hang two decks off the West Span, the suspension bridge –
to make it a bridge to San Francisco.
To make it possible for cyclists and pedestrians to use the bridge. But it's to hang two decks is just an idiotic plan because they're going to take 10 years and it's going to cost $1 billion. And they have to change all the road material in the meantime, which they're going to do anyway, but they want to use that bridge thing to blame it on the bikes. So we have a solution. We have a nice, cheap, fast, easy solution that they could do this tomorrow morning and spend less than $10,000 and do it in 3 hours. In 1962, they reconfigured the Bay Bridge. And as late as 1958, there were trains running on the bottom deck, two tracks of trains coming from Sacramento as well as the key system from Oakland and Berkeley. There were also trucks and whatnot on the bottom. And the top deck, up until 1962, was six lanes of traffic, three lanes going each direction with a center median. So those lanes were obviously a little bit more narrow than they are today. And in 1962, Caltrans reconfigured the bridge so it was five inbound lanes and five outbound lanes with very wide lanes. You might notice when you're on the bridge how wide they are. And they were basically designed to be part of a massive grid of freeways that were going to be imposed on San Francisco. And that freeway plan was rejected by the citizens of San Francisco, much to the horror of the rest of the United States. Like, how could San Francisco vote no on freeways? But it's one of our famous moments here in San Francisco of saying no to that plan of destroying the Valencia-Guerrero corridor with a giant freeway, 7th Avenue coming into Golden Gate Park, the Panhandle Freeway, et cetera.
So and eventually eliminating the Embarcadero Freeway, too.
That was supposed to wrap all the way around the bay, and you never see the water from San Francisco. So there was a lot of crazy plans, and citizens said no. And eventually we took a lot of those freeways down, and so we have even less today. Somehow we're stuck with this legacy reconfiguration of the bridge that was supposed to connect to this high-speed freeway system. And so now it's like, let's remember how they got to be the way it is and remember that it could actually be different. The bridge is not set in cement. So we could actually reconfigure that top deck back to six lanes, narrow the lanes just 2 feet each, easily handle the width of cars that are there, and then slow the speed limit. Right now, the speed limit going through the curve is 35 miles per hour. Nobody's complaining about it. So we think that should be the speed limit on the West Span, 35 miles an hour entering San Francisco. You've got this beautiful view. Calm down. It's only a minute or two longer. And then that sixth lane with a little barrier between it and the car traffic becomes the bike and pedestrian lane on the north side of the bridge with the beautiful views, the pleasant air blowing in, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a very easy solution. Of course, Caltrans doesn't like easy solutions. They want big, expensive solutions that cause them to hire outside contractors and consultants that cost lots of money.
That's Chris Carlson, who runs the historical website Found SF. The Critical Mass co-founder, who is no fan of Caltrans, spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. Do you have a radical idea to share with us? You can call our tip line and let us know about it. The number is 415-264-7106. Again, that number to leave us a message with your radical idea is 415-264-7106. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. Today's team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, Alyssa Kapnick, RTM's Kunahoffs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Lisa Ratner, Seth Samuel, Judy Silber, Ray Sue Sussman, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro, and Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also, thanks to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org.
And thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. You're listening to the Alex Pinto Trio. They'll be performing this Saturday as a presentation of SF Offside, which is a new Bay Area jazz festival. The music starts at 9 p.m. in the Mission. You can find all of the details at our website. It's kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.